origins of some of the stories. Now, he told, Anderson told fairy and folk stories in a new way, a fresh way, with a lot of humour and colloquial speech and his own dialect of his own island of Funen. Of course, he didn't invent the fairy tale, of course not. They've been going around for a long time, and at the turn of the 19th century, all over Europe, there was a great interest in folk tales and fairy tales, originally the doing of two marvellous Frenchmen. We're going to leave this up for a bit. Two fantastic Frenchmen with long curly wigs at the court of Louis XIV. One of them is from Picardy. His name is Antoine Galland. And he was antiquary to Louis XIV. He was an Orientalist. He was an archaeologist. And he translated the Arabian Nights from Arabic into French. The second Frenchman is his friend Charles Perrault, who was a lawyer also at the court of Louis XIV and very well connected. And upon his retirement, he started to collect folk tales from nearer home: Cinderella, Red Riding Hood, Puss in Boots, Sleeping Beauty, and he called them his Conte de ma mère Loi, Mother Goose Tales. Now, they were both at Versailles, and this led to much interest in fairy and folk tales in court circles, where literary ladies started to collect contes de fées and to practice telling them to each other in a lively and elegant manner. You could win a prize for the best telling of a folk tale. They become à la mode at Versailles, and therefore in other parts of Europe. Later, in Germany, at the start of the 19th century, Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm were collecting folk tales, some of them the same as the French ones. And by the 1820s, a great flood of fairy tales from abroad in translation was washing over Denmark. Now, some Danes distrusted this movement. One critic warned in particular, "With this type of poetic gluttony, children's minds will become a junk room filled with fragments of the nation's favourite stories." It sounds like the internet, doesn't it? Yes. But, of course, no one took any more notice than they do today. And by the 1830s and 40s, more and more fairy tale anthologies based on these translations from French and from German, and also on old Danish folk tales, Scandinavian folk tales, now rendered more visible by this new movement. We're to see the light of day and are read aloud at elite gatherings by famous actors. For the Romantic movement had awakened a feeling for primitive culture, folk culture in primitive forms, influenced quite greatly by the German philosopher Herder, who felt that the folk tale reflects the soul of a people. And these ideas now become popular. Well, Anderson, let's see if I can use this better today than I did yesterday. Anderson, this is the main square in Odense, depicted by the artist J.T. Hank, the local artist, who Anderson knew and with whose daughter he was very friendly, Henriette. Here on the right we have the water pump, a main feature in Odense life until the 1850s. And very likely Anderson would have gone with her as a little boy with his mother to collect the water. She didn't have a maid to do it, she would have used him. Certainly, at harvest time, he accompanied her to local farms, and there he listened to local storytellers entertaining harvesters in the barn in the evenings. He almost certainly came here with her, and he tells us in his autobiography that he went quite often with his mother to the local asylum where his father, his father's father, the old woodcarver, very talented, lived now as an inmate. And he heard stories there from the women in the spinning room. These remained in his head, together with other forms of inspiration. At home with his father, composing plays for their puppet theatre, he had happily borrowed whole chunks of other people's plays, composing a version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, of Pyramus and Thisbe from A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which even more people died than in the original. As an adult author, he'd continue to borrow freely, as did Shakespeare, no copyright laws in their day. As we saw, too, he drew inspiration from his own life. The duckling, depicted by this Russian artist, who uses an incident from Andersen's autobiography in which the future writer, wearing new clogs, to which he's very self-conscious, is critically examined by his young peers. That's in the autobiography. And, of course, this artist turns them into the cat and the hen in The Ugly Duckling. And also in his autobiography, Andersen tells us about an occasion going to church in his new red boots and thinking more about them than about God, hence that cruel story of Karen and the red shoes. Childhood memories surface very often in his writings. He writes three autobiographies over the years. The first one, he's 25. When he was 11, his father died of a fever, and his mother marries again. They move to another small house, this one with a long garden stretching down to the Odense River. And he used to spend a lot of time there. This is J.T. Hank again. Andersen would go down by the water wheel. This is near one of the many mills in the country, and he'd spend hours looking at the river, at the water rats and other little animals who come to drink in it. And before long, he would put them into his story, Thumbelina. There she is with a large mole who wants to marry her, but she manages to get away. And still by the river, he tells us this: I used to stand on one of the big stones my mother used for washboards, and I sang with all my might the songs I knew. An old woman who rinsed clothes in the river told me that the Empire of China was situated straight underneath it, and I did not find it impossible that a Chinese prince, one moonlight night when I was singing there, might dig himself through the earth up to me, hear me sing, and take me down with him to China, where I would live and build a castle. That might have been an early inspiration for his story, The Nightingale. And throughout his life, he would hopefully identify with another young man who becomes rich in China, Aladdin in The Arabian Nights. More of that in a moment. Another story based on a childhood memory, not his, but that of his mother, Anne Marie. Anne Marie, Andersen's mother, was one of three illegitimate daughters, all born out of wedlock to one mother, for which the mother was once sent to prison for a week as a punishment. As a little girl, Anne Marie had at least once been sent out to beg. And once, he tells us, when she was either unable to beg or had no luck, we don't quite know which, she didn't dare go home, and spent all day under a bridge crying. Andersen, by the way, would often be asked to read this story at dinner tables, and according to one listener, his reading was even more moving than that of Dickens reading Little Nell. So perhaps his early theatrical ambitions were not entirely wasted or misplaced. Another illustration, a modern French one, of the little match girl. We're going to touch later on some lesser known stories, but I thought I'd begin with the origins of the first four, which were published altogether in May 1835, very economically, in a booklet which we saw yesterday. Here it is, something like that. Almost all his stories were published in leaflet-sized booklets. from this first publication, he received enough money from his publisher to buy just 4 pairs of trousers. In the Harz Mountains, he tells us, in northern Germany, the true spirit of the fairy tale came to me for the first time. I wanted the style to be such that the reader felt the presence of the storyteller, and therefore the spoken language had to be used. I wrote them for children, but older people ought to find them worth listening to. The first 3 I had heard as a child, either in the spinning room or during the harvesting of the hops. Among them, The Tinderbox, about a soldier returning from the wars, a witch, a princess, and 3 magic dogs who guard the treasure. The soldier kills the witch, marries the princess. This story was thought to be immoral by some, as indeed it is. The witch had done him no harm at all. Now, Anderson had 2 sources for this. They both come from the Arabian Nights, the story of Aladdin and the Wonderful Lamp. The first one is a Danish folk tale, which is called The Spirit of the Candle. The second, a very successful romantic play on Aladdin, written by the Danish poet and teacher Adam Oehlenschläger. Now, I've lost Oehlenschläger's dates somewhere on the computer, but you can tell roughly his period by that wonderful Byronic hair he's got. He's about 25 years older than Anderson. He's a sort of father figure. He's much admired. And he was kind to Anderson during his duckling years. Now, this writer, Adam Oehlenschläger, influenced by German friends, it was he who gave impetus to the Romantic movement in Denmark and generally cheered the place up after the loss of Norway. He presents the boy, the poor boy Aladdin, as a romantic hero, predestined for greatness, a theme popular in Denmark after its recent loss of greatness. The poor boy becomes a symbol of hope. Now, but in order to be different from Oehlenschläger, who had taught him from time to time, in order not to copy his teacher, Anderson chooses the folktale version, and he makes variations upon it. Back to that dog again. In the folktale, in the Arabian story, the money is guarded by a genie, the genie of the lamp. So in the folktale, the treasures in the cave are guarded by a sleeping troll. Anderson jollies the whole thing up by substituting 3 dogs. One has eyes as big as teacups. The second dog has eyes as big as mill wheels. And the third dog has eyes as big as the round tower of Copenhagen. Down the country road, a soldier came marching left, right, left, right. He had his knapsack on his back and a sword at his side, for he'd been at the war and now he was on his way home. But then he met an old witch on the road. Oh, she was ugly. Her lower lip hung right down onto her chest. "Good evening, soldier," she said. "What a nice sword you've got, and what a big knapsack. You're a proper soldier. Now, I'll tell you how to get as much money as you want." "Thank you very much, old witch," says the soldier, who's not very nice, even though he's the hero. It's the humour in the story that made it popular. And that is the case with the second folk tale, which comes from much closer to home. It's a Danish folk tale, Big Klaus and Little Klaus, illustrated here by Arthur Rackham. 2 brothers, one of them's in the picture, the other one isn't. This is Little Klaus on the right, poor but cunning. Not in the picture is his brother, Big Klaus, rich but stupid, whom Little Klaus does down in various brutal ways. It's a bit Grand Guignol. The other 2 characters are very important. On the left we have a farmer, and on the right the farmer's wife. And there behind her we have a chest, and she's hidden her lover in the chest because her husband has come home unexpectedly. Now, Anderson has got limitations about what he can write about. He's jolly careful about sex, illegitimacy, and all of that. He can't say in a children's story precisely why she's hidden the chap in the chest. He is a parish clerk. So he makes up a reason perfectly acceptable to children. He says she has to hide the clerk in the chest because the farmer had the strange failing that he never could bear the sight of a parish clerk. This particular folk tales generally have a bit of innuendo in them, or sometimes quite a lot. He could well have heard it from the old women in the spinning room of the Odense hospital, where his father was an inmate and where the old man's wife worked as a gardener, a very suitable arrangement. In his autobiography, he tells us this about one visit to this spinning room, which gives us a super picture of the precocious child. I had accidentally heard, he says, about the internal mechanism of the human frame. Of course, without understanding anything about it, but these mysteries were captivating to me, and so, with chalk, I drew flourishes on the door to represent the intestines, and my description of the heart and lungs made the deepest impression. I passed for a remarkably wise child that would not live long, and they rewarded my eloquence by telling me stories. Well, this could have been one of them, but he doesn't tell which stories. Another one, the third one of the first four, could also have been told him, possibly by the old ladies, and here it is. The Princess and the Pea, where a princess is so sensitive that she can't sleep on this pea, even though it's got 20 mattresses and 20 feather-down eiderdowns beneath, on top of the pea. This was originally a Swedish folktale related to our Dick Whittington story, in which a poor girl goes out into the world with her cat or sometimes dog. The cat or dog tells her to go to the royal castle and present herself as a princess, in order, of course, to marry the prince. The suspicious queen puts the girl to the test by secretly placing a pea or a bean or even a piece of straw under 20 mattresses and 20 quilts to see if she's genuine. The cat or dog warns her, and she deceives the queen and marries the prince. Anderson removes the cat or dog, which I think is a bit of a shame, and he makes the girl into a real princess who really can feel the pee under all those mattresses. I am black and blue all over, she says next morning, and the girl means it in his story. The prince married her. The pea was exhibited in the Royal Museum, says Anderson. And you can go and see it there if it hasn't been stolen. Now, in the story, there's just a lot of other princesses competing for the prince's hand. I must just show you the ones depicted by Heath Robinson. The colours are rather dreary, but never mind. They're all very young, and there are two in particular who are quite irresistible. This one, aged about 5, sitting firmly on the prince's cloak. And that one over there, very hopeful, wearing a plume. I do think they're enchanting. At least one, probably more, highly reputable scholar of folk tales and of Anderson, Jack Zipes, regards Anderson as a closet revolutionary. Polite on the surface and absolutely digging the knife in the guts. He is certainly full of sarcastic humour on the subject of royalty and the upper classes, and in life he is very polite. Yes. Anderson has been born, in a way, at a brilliant time for him, virtually in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and he would live between two totally different worlds, the country world of his youth, or rather that of country people recently come to live in a city, folk customs still in the backs of their heads, and that of a metropolis. with international connections and new inventions constantly springing up. He makes the most of these two worlds, enabled to do so by his jolly good memory and by his ability to be easily enthused. Somewhere he compares himself to water. He says, everything moves me. Everything is reflected in me. His fourth story is the only wholly original one of the first four. A Rackham illustration here, which we saw yesterday. And may I remind you, because of what we're going to see tomorrow, or to do with his paper cut, just look at those kitchen scissors. This is what he cut everything out with. Well, this is an illustration from the fourth story, Little Ida's Flowers. Based on everyday life, Little Ida was the granddaughter of an influential art historian in Copenhagen called Matthias Tjeller. She had already been portrayed, aged only 18 months, by Christian Koepke as a birthday present for her grandfather, and here is the portrait of Little Ida. She had been terribly fidgety, her grandfather would recall later, and they had to hit on a jolly clever wheeze to make her sit still while she was being drawn. As we see, they get her to draw herself with chalk. She's drawing something there, totally absorbed, totally still. She would probably have been very bright, Little Ida. Anderson gets to know her 3 years later. She's 4 and a half, and she's upset that her flowers have died. Anderson, she asks him why. Why should they be alive one day and dead the next? She doesn't understand. Anderson says they've been dancing all night and need putting to bed. And this conversation inspires a story. In the museum in Odense, we can see real Little Ida's doll's cot, with two roses, presumably artificial, there on the pillow. In the story, Little Ida has flowers that are drooping. Someone says they're tired. She puts them in the doll's bed, which makes the doll very jealous, and she's very unkind. Please be a good doll, says Little Ida, and sleep in the drawer tonight. The flowers are sick and have to sleep in your bed. That night, Little Ida, in the story, dreamed that the flowers are having a ball. They danced so gracefully, holding onto each other's leaves. They formed chains and swung each other round, just as children do when they dance. A big yellow lily sat at the piano and played. A blue crocus jumped up onto the table where Ida's playthings were, went right over to the doll's bed, drew the curtains, lay there. There lay the sick flowers, but they weren't sick anymore. They wanted to dance too. But next morning, when she wakes up in the story, they are dead, of course, and she must bury them. Anderson himself loves flowers. He made unusual arrangements. He kept notes so that people have been able to reconstruct precisely what he did and copy them, as they did a few years ago at the Anderson Museum. I'll show you more of these tomorrow, but here's just one. A bouquet of asters from late September. He had some original ideas, too. He made friends easily, and, as I said, was easily influenced by them. Some people thought this was unmanly, but it meant that inspiration was never far away. Here are just a few of the writers and thinkers about 20, 30 years older than him who would influence him to the good. Here they are. Now, we've met this man before, Adam Oehlenschläger, Byronic hair, leader of the Romantic movement in Danish poetry, author of Aladdin. Hans Christian Ørsted, scientist, more of him in a moment, the Grimm brothers, and now this man, Adalbert von Chamisso, naturalist and poet, whose celebrated story of a man who sold his shadow would inspire Anderson. His story is called Peter Schlemiel. Peter Schlemiel sells his shadow to the devil. he is then distrusted by all the human race. He has no shadow. Nobody trusts him an inch. This story was based on Chamisso's own life experience. See the date of his birth, 1781. That is 8 years before the storming of the Bastille. He is born shortly during the Revolution. His family escaped to Berlin. He grows up there, becomes German, becomes a soldier. After the fall of Napoleon, returns to France. There he feels like a German. In Germany, he feels like a Frenchman. Hence his uncomfortable image of a man with no shadow, distrusted by everybody. As he himself in life becomes a renowned botanist, so in the story, his hero can find peace only in nature. Well, there's another outsider. He and Anderson hit it off. He translates some of Anderson's poems and introduces him to kindred spirits in Berlin. This is the man Anderson said he loved more than anybody else in the world. Scientist, physicist, something of a mystic. He wrote a book called The Spirit in Nature. And he gave Anderson something priceless, a vocation, in addition to his own desperate desire for fame. He encouraged him to find both beauty and meaning in the new world of science and to explain it to the man in the street. Oersted's work would lead to the discovery of the principle of electromagnetism, and he believed very genuinely that science and art are linked in a divine order running through everything, and that the artist or poet has a job to explain that order, to make it visible, and to make the man in the street feel it. And he hoped Anderson would become a sort of ambassador for science. And in a way, he tried to. He did write that story called The Millennium, in which young Americans visit London on an airship, spend a day there, then go through the Channel Tunnel to Europe and stay there for a week. He wrote another one called The Great Sea Serpent, very entertaining, in which the electric cable, which was laid at some stage between America and Europe, I don't know the date, is observed by a whole lot of different fish, and they each have their ideas. They think it's an eel, of course, and they try and get signs of life out of it, and they each have different ideas about it. And he wrote a number of other shorter, later stories, which are dedicated sometimes literally to Oersted, but most of them are inspired by him. Oersted also said, at a time when Anderson was only just out of his terrible school, that his stories would make him immortal. And now these two brothers, they started collecting folk tales at the most ghastly time in 1806, when Napoleon's army was running over Prussia and occupying their hometown. First, the study of old German had helped to cheer up the two young men who had lost their father early in childhood and would always be close together. And later, they would find the energy and the enthusiasm to revive the folk beliefs of old Germany. Their first volume of nursery and household tales is published in 1812 during Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, his first big reverse. Everybody was very happy, and it was a big success. The second one appeared in the year of Waterloo and was similarly acclaimed. Now, one last influence, and a most important polymath in his own life, wonderful man, here he is on the right. Now, look, this is E.T.A. Hoffmann, Ernst Theodor Amadeus, named by himself after Mozart, Hoffmann. Author, composer, music critic, caricaturist, conductor, and judge. Author of this story, very readable story, of The Nutcracker and Mouse King, upon which the ballet is based. His very readable story is set in a nursery. It deals with a battle fought between the noble Nutcracker, who is really a prince, and the seven-headed Mouse King, bent on revenge after the murder of his mother, Mouse Mother, Frau Bacon Gobbler. Hoffmann had brought nursery toys to life before Andersen, setting him an example of fantasy writing in a domestic setting. Now, this is Hoffmann's own drawing of his own cat. And this is his story based upon him, the life and opinions of the tomcat Murr. Very readable, very interesting, delightful book. Somewhere, but I'm not quite sure where, I think Andersen does acknowledge a debt to E.T.A. Hoffmann, but perhaps not as often as he should. In 1836, Andersen brings out a little book of stories which includes Thumbelina, The Little Mermaid, and this one. Here we see the Emperor, depicted by Andersen's favourite illustrator, Wilhelm Petersen, a young Danish naval architect who would, alas, die young, and it was very hard to replace him. Now, this story of the emperor's new clothes has had such an extensive life post-Andersen, a sort of posthumous existence, I was most interested to discover that it had had a pre-Andersen life as well. There are several versions of it. His is based on a story from a 14th century Spanish collection of cautionary tales with Arab and Jewish sources collected by a Spanish prince. In this story, a king is hoodwinked by weavers who claim to make a suit of clothes invisible to any man who is not the son of his presumed father. So everyone can see it except for Everyone says they can see it, except for a North African Moor who steps up to the emperor, rubs his eyes and says, "Your Majesty, I never knew my father and I don't care who he was. So I dare tell you to your face that you were riding through the capital completely naked." Now, as I mentioned, Andersen tries to avoid anything to do with sex or birth or bodies or anything. See how modestly his emperor is dressed by this favourite artist. And so he changes the story to a version in which the swindlers claim the clothes are invisible to anybody who is either stupid or no good at his job. The emperor again, more naked by Edmund Dulac. Yes. And the swindler, the emperor falls for it. Now, he falls for it, here he is again. Lovely suspenders, don't you think? Because he hopes he may find out which of his ministers is no good at his job, never dreaming it might apply to himself. Emperors come in all shapes and sizes. And here he is again, on the right, in a woodcut by a German artist. The swindlers decently dressed, the swindlers pretending to weave on empty looms. Then, says Andersen, they pretended to remove the cloth from the loom. They cut the air with big scissors, and they sewed with needles with no thread. "Just look at these trousers," they said. "Here is the jacket. This is the cloak. They are all as light as spiders' webs." And as we know, he takes it all, he walks through the streets, and here they are, running away with the loot. They get away with it. They get away with it in Andersen's story. Well, we don't know. They probably do. Now, the end of the story is what made Andersen's version so popular, and he didn't think of it until he went to the printers. There are theories about how he made this last-minute change. We know that he always read his stories aloud. Perhaps he read it aloud to a child before having it printed. Or maybe he remembered something, as he said just before his death, from his own childhood. He remembered standing in a crowd with his mother, waiting to see King Frederick VI, and crying out, "Oh, he's nothing more than a human being." We don't quite know. Anyway, some child came into his mind. "But he doesn't have anything on," said a little child. And the people whispered among each other and repeated what the child had said. And at last they all shouted, "He has nothing on." The emperor shivered, for he knew that they were right. But he thought, "I must bear it until the procession is over." And he walked even more proudly. And the two gentlemen of the imperial bedchamber went on carrying the train that wasn't there. Now, one's pleased to see, this is the child again by Rackham, one's pleased to see a little girl. In an Indian version of the story, which I don't think Anderson knew, but the actual swindler is a farmer's daughter, overheard by the king, talking with friends, claiming that everyone tells lies because it suits them. The king challenges her on this, he steps out. She gets back at him. She says, "You yourself will tell lies someday." He doesn't believe her. She asks him for some money. She goes away and she comes back and says she has built the most beautiful castle. She then tells the king that God lives in her castle and can be seen by one person at a time, provided they were born in full wedlock. He goes into the palace. The king comes out, says he's seen God. "How can you see God?" asks the girl. "God is a spirit." The king then actually not only admits he hasn't seen God, but is so impressed by the girl that he marries her. The king and the clever girl. An English version of the tale involves a miller. This is a paper cut by Anderson of his Mill Man, one of his favourite subjects. In this English version, a merchant is having a go at a miller. Everybody hated millers because they were thought to be rich, unscrupulous and greedy, particularly greedy. "I have heard," says the merchant, "that every honest miller who tells the truth has a golden thumb." "Yes," says the miller. "May I see your thumb?" says the merchant. Miller shows his thumb. "I cannot perceive your thumb is gold. It's the same as anybody else's thumb." And then the miller says, "My thumb is gold, but you can't see it, for it has the property that he who is a cuckold can never see it." Shakespeare's supposed to have known that joke, and I wouldn't be at all surprised. The Spanish entry to the international competition held in Odense a few years ago for the best illustration of an Anderson story among children no older than 14. Now, lastly, very briefly, there is a Turkish version, for which I don't have a slide, but it's most interesting. In this Turkish version, the garment is not a coat, it is a turban. And you can only see it if you were born in wedlock. What is extraordinary about this version is that the emperor owns up to his viziers, his courtiers, that he can't see the turban. His courtiers then own up to him. And in this Turkish version, unlike all others, the swindlers are found out. Last portrait of the emperor from the international children's competition, and here he is wearing his crown, his robe, and a nice pair of Marks and Spencer's knickers. Now, Anderson seems to have been more or less bisexual, and suffered certainly very emotional, and throughout his life, especially in his youth, but not only in his youth, suffered lots of unrequited love for people of both sexes. He uses it as comedy, and in a fairly early story, it was great fun, it's called The Collar, he sends himself up, I love this illustration, by Chris Riddle, who was born in South Africa, as you see, a gentleman's collar is desperate to get married. He proposes first to a lady's garter who snaps at him. Next, newly starched, lying on the ironing board, he proposes to the iron. "Madam," began the collar, as soon as he saw the warm iron, "I assume you are a widow. The very sight of you makes me warm, and all my wrinkles disappear." "Please, will you marry me?" "Rag," snarled the iron as it passed proudly over the collar, imagining that it was a steam engine drawing a whole string of railway cars behind it. "Rag," it repeated, as on its return journey. Next, the collar proposes to a pair of scissors. "What leg movement," he says. "You must be a ballerina. I've never seen anything so elegant." "I know," said the scissors. "You deserve to be a countess," said the collar. "All I have is a bootjack, a comb, and a gentleman to wait upon me. I wish I were a count." "Is he proposing?" snarled the scissors, and she was angry. She really cut the collar, and the collar gets desperate. "I suppose I'd better propose to the comb. How pretty your teeth look, miss, and you have not lost one of them. Tell me, have you never thought of marriage?" "Didn't you know," said the comb and blushed, "that I am engaged to the bootjack?" And the collar gets very cynical and ends up as a rag in the paper mill. And, says Anderson, this story is printed upon him, and he says, "How can you be sure that you won't end in the rag pile? To be made into paper and have your whole life story, even the most intimate and secret parts, printed upon you, and then, like the rag, have to run round the world telling everybody about it." Which, perhaps, is what he felt he was doing himself, and so in the end, I think it's rather a black story. A yet blacker one is this story, The Shadow, derived from this man's story, Adalbert von Chamisso, who wrote the story about the man with no shadow. In Anderson's version, it's completely different. It is set in Naples, where the light and shadow are, of course, much more marked than in the north. It is about a poor, good philosopher who cares only for truth and beauty. Somehow his shadow, we don't really hear how, it acquires a life of its own and goes poking about the neighborhood houses, discovering everybody's dark secrets, becoming very cynical. It blackmails all the neighbors, becomes rich, and then can patronize the philosopher who will always remain poor. "I'll take you on holiday," says the shadow, "and pay for everything, provided you allow me to call you my shadow." Here the shadow dances with a beautiful princess. There's the philosopher in the doorway. And when the philosopher tries to explain to the princess that the shadow is a shadow, the shadow has him killed. Same subject by... Now, there is a most interesting reference in here to Anderson's lifelong friendship with Edouard Colline. Some years ago, Edward had turned down Anderson's earnest request that the two of them might say "du" to each other, which is, of course, the equivalent of the French "tu." Edward, rather upper class, rather conservative, couldn't face doing that. And Anderson was very hurt. He really wanted it. He was very hurt. In the story of The Shadow, the scholar suggests to the shadow, when the shadow's rich by now, that they might say "du" to each other. His shadow's reply is thought to echo that of Edouard Colline. "What you say," says the shadow, "sounds very frank. I'm sure that you mean well. I too mean well, and I will be as frank. As a learned man, you know how queer nature is. Some people can't bear the feel of grey paper. Others go all goosey if you scrape a nail against a pane of glass. That's how I feel when I hear you saying do to me. It's not pride, it's only what I feel. But although I can't allow you to say do to me, I am willing to meet you halfway and say do to you." But it's more complicated than that. Edward was a true friend, as he proved with regard to the story. Anderson writes it in Naples, sends it in rather ghastly handwriting to Edward, who, unasked, writes out the whole thing in nice handwriting and sends it to the German translator, which Anderson had never asked him to do. Possibly it was his way of saying sorry. Anderson was overjoyed, but Edward still couldn't bring himself to say do to Hans Christian Andersen. Another black tale, a drop of water, written for Ørsted the scientist, illustrated here in the 1860s by a German artist whose name I don't know. This old gentleman, looking through his magnifying glass at a drop of ditch water, is horrified to see 1,000 tiny animals jumping about, crowding each other like a plate of live shrimps. They kicked and cuffed each other, they beat and kicked and shoved. Those who were on the bottom strove to get to the top. Those on the top struggled to get to the bottom. But what do you think it is? Asks this old man of a neighboring troll. That's easy, says the troll. It's Copenhagen. It's ditch water, says the old man. And so much for Danny Kaye and wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen, depicted very charmingly by Heinrich Hansen in the 19th century. Well, the truth is, Anderson feels free abroad. At home, he feels that everyone is getting at him all the time, as quite often they are. And they don't do it abroad. Now, in 1847, he has this great success in London. He's feted all over the place by the highest people in society, and he will have a tremendous effect upon children's writing from that day to this. Then he gets back to Denmark and is immediately sarcastically observed by a newspaper descending from heaven with his stories under his arm. Very hurtful when you've just been praised to the skies. And his neighbours do hurt him, and now he puts it into his stories. There is a lesser-known story called The Teapot. How are we for time? Oh, we're all right, yes. Here's an illustration to Anderson, Rackham, of course, to another story, which we won't worry about, but just concentrate on that very nice teapot in the stove. Once there was a teapot who was very proud. She was proud of being porcelain. She was proud of her spout, and she was proud of her broad handle, for they gave her something to boast about, both in front and in back. She didn't talk about her lid, which had been broken off and then glued together. There is no point in talking about your own shortcomings. Others willingly do that for you. The cups, the cream pitcher, the sugar bowl, the whole tea service preferred discussing the mended lid to talking about the fine spout and the strong handle. And this the teapot knew. I know what they think, she said to herself. And I know my own faults too, and I admit them, and I call that modesty and humility. We all have faults, and we have our talents too. The cups have a handle, and the sugar bowl has a lid, but I have both. And one thing more that neither one of them will ever have, a spout. That is what makes me queen of the tea table. The sugar bowl and the cream pitcher are servants of taste, but I am its mistress. I disseminate my blessings among a thirsting humanity in my interior. Fragrant Chinese leaves are mixed with boiling, bubbling water. That was how the teapot talked when she was young. One day, when she was standing on the tea table, she was lifted by a refined and delicate hand. Unfortunately, the refined and delicate hand was also careless. The teapot fell to the floor, and both her spout and her handle were broken off. We won't talk about the lid because that's been mentioned enough already. The teapot fainted. There she lay with boiling water pouring out of her. But the worst was yet to come. They laughed at her, not the careless hand that has dropped her. I shall never forget it, never, she would mutter to herself when she talked about her youth. They said I was an invalid and put me in a corner of the closet, but I didn't stay there long. Next day I was given to a beggar woman who had come to ask for leftovers from the table. I was to know poverty, and the thought made me speechless, and yet there and then began what I would call a better life. One is one thing and one becomes another. I was filled up with earth, which for a teapot is the same as being buried. But within the earth, a bulb was placed. I don't know who put it there, but there it was. I'm sure it was meant as a substitute for the Chinese leaves and the boiling water, and to console me for my broken spout and lost handle. The bulb lay in the earth inside me, and it became my heart, my living heart. I was alive, something I'd never been before. Within me were power and strength, and my pulse beat. The bulb sprouted. It was so filled with thoughts and feelings that it almost burst, and then it flowered. I could see it. I carried it within me, and I forgot myself when I looked at its beauty. Oh, that is the greatest blessing, to be able to forget yourself in caring for others. The flower didn't say thank you. I don't think it even noticed me, but everyone admired it, and that made me so happy. One day I heard someone say that the flower was so lovely it deserved a finer flower pot. They cracked me in two, and that hurt. My plant was placed in a finer flower pot. I was thrown out into the yard, and there I lie, an old broken piece of crockery. But I have my memories, and they cannot be taken from me. Now, Anderson maintained that he was not a writer only for children, and I think that story proves him right. There is time for just one more short one. I will tell you, very short, shorter than that one even, I'll tell you the title at the end of the story, and that'll be the end of this session. The wise men in ancient times had a way of telling people the truth without being rude. They held up in front of them a mirror in which animals and the strangest things appeared. They called it a fable. And whatever foolish or wise deeds the animals did were meant as lessons to the people who saw it. They would realize this and say to themselves, "It is I the fable is about." But no one had said this to them, and therefore there was no reason for anyone to be angry. Let me, as an example, tell you one. There were two high mountains, and on top of each one of them there was a castle. Down in the valley, a dog ran sniffing about, trying to find the scent of a mouse or partridge. Suddenly, from one of the castles, a trumpet blew, which was a signal that dinner was served. The dog immediately ran up the mountain, hoping to get a few scraps, but when it got halfway up, the trumpet call ceased. Then the trumpet from the other castle was blown. Now the dog thought, "Here they will have finished eating by the time I get there, but in the other castle they are just sitting down to table." So it ran down the mountain and started up the other mountain. But before it had gone halfway up, the first trumpet was sounded again, whereas the second one could be heard no more. The dog ran down and up again, and so kept changing mountains until both trumpets were silent, and the meal was over in both castles before the dog arrived at either one. Guess what the ancient wise men wanted to tell us with this fable? And who is the fool that keeps running back and forth until he is tired, without ever gaining anything? And the title of the story is It Is Us the Story Is About. Thank you very much. See you tomorrow.